Blog Talk Radio.
If she could tell I'm hard right now. Yeah, come on, dance for me, baby. Yeah. Uh-oh, you feel like? All right, come on, don't stop now. You done did it. Come on, yeah. All right, hold up.
Can't deny it, but I know you can tell I'm excited. Oh, girl, dance like you're dancing. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Thank you for tuning in to Locker Talk and the Bachelor News Radio Network, where you hear about NFL stars of tomorrow, today. I'm your host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of Locker-Report.com. You guys can always reach out to me directly on any one of my social handles at Twitter on LockerScore or Locker_Report, on Facebook, LockerReport.com, or Locker Talk Podcast, on Instagram, LockerReport100, all small caps, or you can simply shoot me an email at BarryBarnes@Locker-Report.com. Well, I hope everyone is doing well. Hope everyone is still staying safe. Everyone is still staying healthy, considering what our country is going through with the coronavirus pandemic that we're still facing, though that we had a lot of lives that was lost because of this, this unseen enemy. But yet there are a lot more people that's recovering that actually attained the virus, and we just wish that to, you know, have all our prayers out to all those who's going through it but coming out of it, Dylan and his mom, you know, people who I know is close to someone that I do know. So we just want to continue to keep our prayers sent out to them and the thousands of people that are recovering. And that part we will celebrate continuously. But hopefully everyone is doing fine, everyone is safe. And you guys, thank you for tuning in to Locker Talk during this situation. And you know that when you call it, when you listen to Locker Talk, we're going to talk about some NFL stuff. And today, there's a lot of good information in regards of the NFL surrounding the NFL Regional Combine platform. As we know that last week was the 2020 NFL Draft. And for years, we always look for the excitement, for the exciting part of seeing the players walk across the stage, shake Commissioner Roger Goodell's hand, you know, and see the young men in the green room in the back with their personal interviews and seeing their tears flow because, hey, it's an accomplishment that for young men to be able to make a decision at a very young age. Some guys were a lot younger, but made the commitment and had the discipline and sacrificed a lot of things. You know, sacrificed a lot as far as being a child or being a teenager. Not saying that they did not have fun with some of the things they did, but there still was a lot of sacrifices, a lot of times they had to say no because they knew they had to focus on their craft and becoming a football player, and not just becoming just a football player, but to become an NFL player. And to see the young men in their emotion, you know, for the first part, you would think that, okay, this year's draft, knowing they were going to do everything virtual. And quite frankly, when it comes to the draft anyway, they do everything by the phone anyway. So about 90% is done by the phone anyway. So that part was not going to change. And fortunately, that was a process the league was already into. But to be able to not see that part, I would say that part was the one that I missed the most. Not so much about the fans booing Roger Goodell or, you know, acting funny and stuff, acting crazy and stuff out in the field. Although that's nice and that's a part of the experience. But that was one of those type of things. I said, okay, well, if I had to do without something, that part I would do without. But missing the walk across the stage, shaking the commissioner's hand, knowing that you accomplished one feat, then it's all about from that point on staying in the league and being successful from there. But just getting there alone means a lot. And so last week we had the virtual. It went very well. Actually, was the most highest rated viewership out of all the drafts in that 100 year history. You know, the pandemic, yes, did that play a role? Yes, it did, because, you know, it gave some sense of some kind of sport. You know, this country had missed sports, and then to actually have something that was accurate instead of looking at old reruns from ESPN and NFL Network, we had something live. And so that helped towards it. But to see how it worked out for us, seeing the humanizing the GMs and the coaches around their families, it gave another aspect for us, the other side, being humanized, and still was able to see the kids at home with their families, with their friends, still seeing that emotion, but this time instead of being having an interview from someone with one of the networks, they were with their family members and everything, and that was great. So that take from the draft last week was awesome, but for me, it always comes down to the third day. It always comes down to the players that came through the NFL Regional Combine. Now, this year, unfortunately, because of the pandemic, there were no workouts. But, however, there were still players that were on the list. They still were players that had, I would say, some sort of an eye that was on them. That's why they were invited to the Invitational. No different of how they were invited, how players get invited to the National Scouting Combine. And so with that lined up for these guys, they were definitely on the radar. And still, without the workout, these guys are still pioneers in their right in being a part of the NFL Regional Combine process. And last week, history was actually made. In 2000, my memory served me. Yes, it does. Says it very well. Then in 2016, the NFL Regional Combine platform had helped produce five undrafted players. Helped produce five drafted players, excuse me. And during the previous years from that platform, the platform, NFL Football Operations would be lucky to get probably two players. I mean, one player was a celebration. It was a party. You know, if you wind up having a draft where it was two guys, man, we were beside ourselves. Like, wow, we got two guys, you know, drafted, which is a big deal. And so when 2016 rolled around, there were five players that were drafted in that draft class. And I tell you, it really helped took the platform to another level, how it showed even more credibility and value within the true NFL decision makers. We had Trevor Davis. He was the first one to go in that draft by the Green Bay Packers, who came from California on the fifth round. He was the 163rd overall pick. And then Dontayvious Brown, who was a linebacker, who is currently now with the Philadelphia Eagles. He was drafted by the San Diego then Chargers, now Los Angeles Chargers, in the fifth round at the 175th overall pick. In the sixth round of that draft, Mike Thomas, wide receiver from Southern Mississippi, he was drafted by the Los Angeles Rams, and he went 206th overall. Now Mike is now a part of the Cincinnati Bengals wide receiving core. And linebacker Gunther Cruchet-Hill from Eastern Illinois, he was drafted by the New England Patriots in the sixth round at a 208th overall. Now, currently, Cruchet Hill is now a member with the Miami Dolphins. And Tennessee Titans defensive end, current defensive end for the Tennessee Titans, Jonathan Woodyard, he was drafted by the Jacksonville Jaguars in the seventh round at a 226th player overall. Five players. And right now, Trevor Davis, he's a member of the Miami Dolphins wide receiver corps, pretty much a return man. With this class, to be able to be drafted and then at the same time be drafted in their own right late in the sixth or seventh round, they were able to be productive. And the best part is that they're still in the league. So they really have shown that their value, that they truly were NFL players that can be relied on. And during this whole journey, Cruchet Hill was able to win a Super Bowl as they beat the New England Patriots a couple of years ago in Super Bowl 52. So that was an accomplishment, and he played a significant role. And the part that made that game so great was that New England Patriots, although they drafted him, they wound up releasing him before they set their 53-man roster. And a week later, that's when the Philadelphia Eagles had swooped in. He came in as a special teams player. I talked to him at the workout when they worked out in the Minnesota held trials. Very young, very nice young man, but very motivated and focused. And from just my brief time with him and evaluating him, I had said to myself that with the Patriots letting him go like that, he's going to have that's going to be added venom for this young man. Went to the Eagles, made that roster. Special teams ace. He even kicked one game when their kicker went down. When he had a kick against the Dallas Cowboys, he kicked the field goal and had a kickoff. I mean, this dude is like a Swiss Army knife. The following year, he wound up becoming captain, started getting more playing time with the defensive unit, and then as the year had started to progress, Carson Wentz went down. That's when Nick Foles stepped in. Next thing you know, fly, Eagles fly, all the way to the Super Bowl. And when they met, I said, I know Cruce Hill is licking his chops to get at the Patriots. And he did a fantastic job in that game, and they ultimately have won the Super Bowl. So definitely was really, really happy and excited for Cruce Hill to be able to win the Super Bowl with the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, Trevor Davis, coming from the Green Bay Packers, bounced around, went to the Oakland Raiders last year, then found himself with the Miami Dolphins towards the end of the season. And Octavius Brown, his rookie year in 2016, he led the Chargers in tackles and then finished the next 2 years on the team in the top three in tackles. So he really showed his productivity. Now he's with the Philadelphia Eagles getting ready for that big payday. So with all that being said, that core group of that were drafted, they were able to not only sustain but be successful, and they're still currently in the league. Now, with the players that were drafted this year, the question is, although there were 9 players that were drafted, which is significant, you know, something to celebrate, but will these guys actually be able to get to a point where they can be able to hang and stay loose and be productive enough to be able to sustain a career in the NFL? And if that is able to happen, that's going to be tremendously, it's going to be huge. So I'm just going to go through these 9 players that were drafted from the NFL Regional Combine platform, which was fantastic and was great. The first player that was picked from the Detroit Lions, running back Jason Huntley from New Mexico State, 5'9", 193 pounds. Now, when evaluating this man, looking at his tape, several tapes and everything, it was, breathtaking the way how this young man is. And if I can describe him in one word, I would say explosive. He's very dangerous in the open field, excellent in tight spaces, has great feet and hands. He can run the route tree from the backfield with no exceptions. That is huge. You know, the type of player that can be all set up, ready to go, that can be versatile from the backfield, and then at the same time be a dangerous receiver, that is something to behold. He's very agile. He's shifty. He's had a great start and go and plant and go. Very smart, great vision and awareness, has balance and control, solid pad level, and his all-purpose talent. So he can actually get back there and return punts and also return kickoffs. And he has pretty much breakaway potential on every touch. That's great. The Detroit Lions have something in this young man, and the Detroit Lions definitely need some run support, a running game, and this young man will bring it to the table for them as a bell cow. So the Detroit Lions, you got someone there. He was drafted right in the 5th round at the 172nd overall player. You listen to Locker Talk on the Bachelor News Radio Network, where you hear about NFL stars of tomorrow today. Now, for the Kansas City Chiefs, in the 5th round, they picked up D lineman Mike Dana from out of Michigan, 6'2", 261 pounds. He was drafted 177th overall in the 5th round. Now, this young man have a great push power, have good quarterback pressure, high and low body strength. When you look at his size, when you look at him, although he stands 6'2", but at 261 pounds, I would say that's a whole bunch of muscle right there that he is using. He have good feet, strong hands, use good hand usage, have a good push-pull technique where he will be able to grab his opponent, push him, and then pull him back so that he can get by him on the edge. That's one of his, his main moves, his go-to move, and he's very successful with that. He have great pad level, good leverage, high motor, very agile, good lateral movement, and he's very, very detailed, very detailed. So that's something to watch out for what the Kansas City Chiefs was able to get, a viable player that can come on their defensive line, but most importantly, make some waves right there on the special team. Now, getting moving into the sixth round, we're not surprised to see that this pick when the Carolina Panthers, knowing that their new head coach who was just got finished coaching Baylor, they wound up picking Robertson Roy from Baylor, 6'1", 333-pound D tackle. For his size, he's another young man that's very agile. He went in the sixth round, 184th overall. He can handle double teams. He's one of those type of interior linemen that his numbers is not going to reflect a whole lot because the type of double teams that he will command is that because he's one of those type of players that will sacrifice his stats so that the other D guys can get around him. But there's a reason why he's always commanding double teams, because for someone his size, he is extremely quick. Quick feet, very strong, great push. He claws at the middle. He have good inside technique, good leverage. He also, for his size and for what he does, he actually good, have good quarterback pressure, good balance and control, and he always keep his eyes on the backfield, and he's very savvy. The savvy part really comes in knowing that, hey, if I take on these two guys, it's going to free someone up on the edge or it's going to free my linebacker to come up. So a lot of times he will take on a double team, and that's really not really trying to double team him. He'll just move a player over just to collide with another old lineman just to be able to take up that double team to free things up. I'm telling you, the player you got to definitely watch out for, Roy, he's going to be something special. Now, for the Minnesota Vikings, in the sixth round, they drafted Brandell, 6'7", 305 O-lineman, pretty much as a tackle. Olden also played a guard position. He went 203rd overall in the sixth round, and he's very agile and quick, very explosive off the snap. As soon as that ball is up, he is up. Solid technique with both hands and his feet, very smart. You got to be smart and be an offensive lineman, so that's not a surprise there. He has solid strength, both upper and lower strength, which is something that a lot of offensive linemen don't have. They're either strong in one or the other. They probably have tremendous upper body strength or tremendous lower body strength. He has the whole component from top to bottom. He have good change of direction, have good balance, very savvy, good inside technique, good push. And he also is really good at being a pass protector. That's his strength. Although he can provide run support because his stamina is really good, but his strength is pass protection. And you want to make sure you have someone back there to help protect Kirk Cousins so that he can be able to have that little bit more time, have the extra second that he needs to find his players down the field. So that was a good value there they found for the Minnesota Vikings in the sixth round. Staying in the sixth round, now, I really like this guy. He looked like, you know, Troy Polamalu with his hair hanging out in the back. How he moved out there, he looked like him. Didn't say he played like him. I say he looked like him. And so, as far as the way how he looked, he can probably remind you of Troy with all his hair hanging out, all that curly hair coming out. Only thing different, he's a linebacker. His name is Jordan Glasgow from Michigan. 6'1", 226 pounds. Extremely solid. The Indianapolis Colts got a steal out this young man in the sixth round, 213th overall. In one word to describe this young man, he is relentless. He's hard-nosed, great feet, his balance control, aggressive yet patient, very instinctive. He knows how to put pressure on the quarterback from his position. He always keeps his eyes to the backfield, has great technique, and fundamentally sound. He's a pure tackler. He's not going to be a hitter. He's not a hitter. He's going to wrap you up, and he's going to wrap you up from your waist and bring you all the way down to his legs and use his body with the leverage. A pure tackler. And on special teams, he is exciting. He have a spot. I can just go off on a limb and say that this young man is going to make that 53-man roster. I'm just going to call it out right now. He's going to make that roster. Has strong hands, calculated, very athletic. has a lot of hustle, high motor. Most importantly, he is disciplined. So that is the components that you want to have when you have a good young linebacker coming in. So he's going to be in some good company there with the Indianapolis Colts. Now, the Chicago Bears enter into the seventh round. They wind up picking another good offensive lineman, and his name is Arlington Hambright from out of Colorado. 6'5", 300 pounds. This dude is a pure leader, a pure motivator. He is always in the trenches, always in the ears of his teammates, trying to get the best out of him. He has good inside technique. He's solid, so he has solid lower strength, not that strong up top, but he definitely has solid lower body strength. Very powerful, and he's nasty. Good feet, have good hand usage, good against speed rushes. So that's really key. When you're going to play against the NFL, they have some elite rushers coming off the edge, and he's really good against speed rushes. Has strong hands, recovers very well, and yet have good and also keep his pads up high and very disciplined. So the Chicago Bears definitely got themselves a solid offensive lineman there. Definitely want to get his upper body strength, you know, you definitely want to get stronger up top for sure. But he do have the components to be a solid offensive lineman. You listen to Locker Talk on the Ambassador News Radio Network, where you hear about NFL stars of tomorrow or today. Your host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of Locker-Report.com. Now we're moving on. With the New York Giants, they found themselves another good player themselves, a linebacker in this core group with T.J. Brunson from out of South Carolina. South Carolina had a good draft this year. Folks, I don't know if you have watched the draft, but they had some good pieces this year. And a couple of them came through the NFL Regional Combine Invitational because they felt as though they were not getting the love that they deserve. So it was good to see that T.J. was able to get drafted by the New York Giants. He's 6'1", 230 pounds. He was selected in the seventh round, 238th overall. And another word I can say for him in one word is that he's a tracker. You know, he's always on the hunt, always keeping his eyes on the ball. You cannot fool him. That's one of the best things about him. He's not easily tricked. He has good closing speed, strong upper body, great awareness, great vision, very, very aggressive. He's athletic, and he can cover downfield. He's good against the run. He puts on good pressure. He's quick, have active hands, soft hands because he's back there and he takes care of the ball when it's in the area. He has solid leverage, good burst, instinctive, shoots the gap very well, solid lateral movement, and can go sideline to sideline with a high motor that he has. So that was another solid pick that the Giants have. Definitely going to have to make his way onto the special teams, but knowing that the Giants are trying to build up their defense, he definitely could find a home there with the 53-man roster. And the Minnesota Vikings, at it again, they go and find themselves another offensive lineman in Kyle Hilton from Washburn, 6'2", 295 pounds in the seventh round, 253rd overall. For his size, he's very athletic at 6'2", very powerful. He moved very fluently. He had good balance control, solid lateral movement, good technique, agile. He's an aggressive blocker and explosive off the snap. He has good quick change of direction, opens his hips very well, and he can get to the second level. As far as being to get to the second level as a blocker. So he's not just one of those players that can actually just be in one spot or one area or protecting one area, but he can actually get to the next level to help provide extra blocking down the field. That really speaks of his athleticism and with what the Vikings have there in their running core, knowing that they're going to need some extra help down there with Dalvin Cook, who's becoming a great back in the league, can possibly be an elite running back in the next coming years. He's going to have that extra protection down the field. That's going to be great for him. And to close out the draft, Mr. Irrelevant. This year actually goes to a player from the Regional Combine platform. and that's Ty Crowder from out of Georgia, linebacker, 6'3", 235 pounds. Now, normally in the sixth and seventh round, I will always say to myself that it's not a lock like the fifth round and up for the most part. When you get to the fourth round, you're pretty much going to be a player for that team that year. But when you get to the fifth round starting to have value, so you can consider saying, yeah, well, my chance of being in the NFL is really good. But when you get to the sixth and seventh round, folks, that's when it becomes more of, okay, you pretty much almost like an undrafted free agent to that aspect. It's just that they wanted to get a hold of you a little sooner because if the teams feel as though if they let you go to a certain player become undrafted, that the player may have more opportunities to go somewhere else. Other teams may call. So in the sixth or seventh round, the team basically is saying, look, we're going to invite you to camp early. This is going to be – we just going to let you know that we're getting you. We just don't want nobody else to get you. So you still got to make the team, but there's a lot of stuff in you that we like. We just want to grab you early just in case you might choose to go to another squad and they'd be kicking themselves. So the sixth and seventh round is not one of those rounds where it's like, okay, concrete, you want to make this team. It's one of those things they're just making that phone call that's a little earlier than the phone calls that comes after the draft is over. And when you have a player like Crowder that dropped that low, he definitely is one of those type of players. You know, he may got that term as irrelevant, but I think he's going to be very relevant for the years to come in the NFL. From out of Georgia, linebacker, 6'3", 235 pounds. He explodes through his hips, has a strong grip, fast, has good speed, strong, aggressive, have great closing speed, has leverage, great balance, great against the run, good hands and feet. His hands are always active, athletic, very intense. He flies around the ball and gets to the backfield, a very fiery player. They can play from sideline to sideline. And in most cases, whatever number that he obtained from the Giants when he was in Georgia, his number was 30. He literally was in on every play, whether he was there at the beginning or he was coming to finish. He was in on every play. And I expect him to be the same way in the NFL, always in on every play, every defensive stop, because he's just that type of talent that he's just going to fly, man. He's not going to hold back whatsoever. This kid is the real deal. So with the names of the listings of the players from the NFL Regional Combine that were drafted, the highest number of players that was in this platform that was ushered. Like I said, there were no workouts this year, but their names are still on the list, so it's still – qualify these guys for being pioneers and qualify me to be able to say, hey, I'm going to cover these guys for their whole careers and I'm going to follow them and keep track of these guys. So they were able to be the nine that was drafted. Now, next week, we're going to jump in and talk about the other players from the regional combine that were not drafted but were signed. There were 36 players that were signed that received that phone call right after the draft, and that is a significant high number, the highest since 2017 when 38 players were got that phone call, received that phone call. So this regional combine draft was really strong. And then leading into the following week, we're going to get into the HBCU. I purposely did not talk about them just yet because I'm still waiting to see who else may get an invite or who may get signed. So I want to make sure I have my numbers and facts right when I get into that. If I was to talk about it today, you guys probably wouldn't like what I had to say. But in 2 weeks, I definitely will dive into that platform, and hopefully I have a special guest on that show to talk about that. You listen to Locker Talk on the Bachelor News Radio Network, where you hear about NFL stars of tomorrow today. I'm your host, Barry Bonds, founder and CEO of Locker-Report.com. Go to that site. If you guys want to get caught up on the content that's there now that I didn't talk about on the show today, hey, go for it. Check it out. Also, come to any one of my social handles on Twitter at Locker_Report, Facebook, LockerReport.com, or Locker Talk Podcast, on Instagram, LockerReport100, all small caps, or you guys can simply shoot me an email, at BarryBarnes@locker-report.com. Make sure you guys always tune in to the Bassett News Radio Network, where we are covered with all kinds of shows that covers everything from politics, religion, entertainment, social matters, everything. Now we even have a new show called You and the Law. Check that out. We have some legitimate police chiefs that, hey, say, look, let's start a podcast. Make sure you guys tune in. They should be launching that show next week. So stay tuned and follow Bassett News Radio Network, because this network is growing. Everyone stay blessed. Please tune in next week. We'll get into some more NFL talk, the guys from the NFL Regional Combine. Everyone stay blessed, safe. Wash your hands and keep your face covered. I'm out. Everyone stay. Have a good one now.
With the Mighty Oba. Today we have one of the most distinguished guests we have ever had. He is part of the longest legacy of black journalism in Western New York. My good friend, Brother Frank Merriweather III.
That's
we have
it.
To distinguish that, the third,
yes,
because there are three
That's right.
Franks.
Yes,
and
yes.
A lot of people get them confused. Am I correct?
That they do. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm glad to be in the house with the Oba.
We're going to have some fun while we're here. Hope everybody tunes in because a lot of times they don't get an opportunity to hear Frank really disseminate some of the history of black journalism in Western New York, and he has played a major, major part in that for several years. First, Frank, I wanted to ask you, how did the Merriweathers arrive here in Buffalo and Western New York?
Pat, Texas, Tuskegee, New York City, and to our humble abode here in Buffalo, New York, or their humble abode, Western New York. My grandparents were from the southern part of Texas, and actually went to Tuskegee
mm-hmm.
University and did some traveling around the country. At least my granddad did. My grandmother was a school teacher in Texas. And ended up in New York City. My granddad, Frank Merriweather Sr.'s very good friend, Adam Clayton Powell Sr., was able to get him a job in the printing industry in the New York City area.
Mm-hmm.
He was there for a little bit. In fact, my grandmother was there for a little bit. Didn't necessarily like the environment, per se, in New York for raising children. She goes back to Texas, and granddad lands a job in Buffalo. Mm. And the rest is history, I guess, Pat, huh? And I guess I should clarify those dates. I would say maybe around 1920 ended up here in Buffalo. And then went into business and started the Buffalo Criterion Press,
mm-hmm.
which was a printing outfit there. and they did what you call job work, tickets, posters, raffles, church bulletins.
Invitations, things like that. Was that the basis of the relationship, the long relationship with the black church? Did it start from the printing business?
Yeah, because, you know, at that time, you didn't have mimeograph machines. And so we did a lot of church programs, anniversaries, and that kind of thing. And so that was maybe our introduction into the black church. And then at that time, too, very small population in terms of the black community here. So it was pretty close-knit, I understand. And my grandfather had an interest in politics as well, and so...
Now, he was a Republican.
He was a Republican at
now,
that time.
Now, people need to realize that back then...
That's right.
Most Africans that lived here in America were
Republican
if they were politically active.
That's right, based on Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
Yeah, in fact, there's a term, Lincoln Republican.
Right.
Yeah, and so... he had a real do-for-self kind of attitude, which was instilled at Tuskegee in terms of dropping your bucket where you were and going to work. Mm. And prior to going into the printing business, he did a lot of other things. He was a tailor by trade, worked at a jewelry store, worked on the railroad. So he did a number of different ventures, per se, before landing here. And he did like Buffalo.
And your grandmother was Carmelita.
My grandmother's Carmelita, Mary Weather. So she came and was very active. In fact, they started a Republican club called the Booker T. Washington Republican Club. The woman's auxiliary was the Martha Washington Republican Club. And they did a lot of things like voter registration, voter education, that kind of thing. You don't necessarily hear about voter education now.
Mm.
There's a lot of emphasis on registration and such. And I guess maybe that's the intro, per se, to politics. But after that, the education component.
Were you familiar with your grandparents? Did you get to meet them?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you know, it was a funny thing, especially, you know, my grandmother. I actually saw my grandmother 5 days a week, 5 to 7 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, she was a very integral part of our business. And, you know, just as a youngster, I saw her do some very, very, very amazing things. And at that time, in my youth, I hadn't seen any other woman in the newspaper business do.
Mm-hmm.
She covered stories. She sold ads. She was active in a lot of the clubs, but the business end, she was able to work. I use the term in the front office and in the back office. The back office is where all the printing and all of the typesetting and all of that takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And so she just wasn't able to take news in or take an order in for a poster or a raffle ticket or a program. She was able to typeset that work and then put it on a press and give you a finished product.
So when did the Buffalo Criterion really start as a weekly newspaper? What
1925. Yeah. Comes in at that time with the famous Michigan Avenue Y and Urban League. Those organizations were about 2 years apart. We started in 23. I believe the Michigan Avenue Y, 1925, and the Urban League, which was known as the Chapel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether, I guess it grew out. I don't specifically know the history of the Urban League, but I know they started in 1927.
Mm.
Yeah, so we're just a few years apart.
Now tell me the early years of the Buffalo Criterion. How did they How many were they putting out there? Was it?
Well, it was a, you know, as I said, at that time, and, you know, I just spoke to some young people not long ago, and I was saying, at that time, communities were always pushing for civil rights, and you had to have a means of communication. Now, no Skype, Pat.
Right.
You know, no Facebook. You know, understand. You know, and oftentimes when we hear about the civil rights movement, not much is really said about the black press, but that was the means of communication,
right,
that we had. It was the black press, the civil rights organization, and the church, because usually that was the venue,
right,
in which we were able to get large amounts of folks there. So, but as I said, not much is said.
Was that the bulk of the distribution of the church?
Well, yeah,
through the churches?
But also we had a partnership with the Black Civil Rights Organizations, because really at that time it was a concerted effort to forward the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were using every means at your disposal at that point to do some of the work, because, you know, oftentimes you forget when you're looking to do that kind of work, man, it's a lot of heavy lifting. Everybody has a little part to play, you know, in that. And the black press's role was to get that word out and really to distinguish your story from that of major media.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where that theme that you oftentimes put on the paper, we want to tell our own story.
Well, yeah, that and our theme for a number of years is educating and building, you know, because that's the thing that you really want to do. You want to educate people as in terms of or telling your story. I think that's just the most important kind of thing. Setting out your history so that, Pat, you know I like to take pictures.
Right,
you
right. Know. That's your thing.
But one of the reasons why I do that, because I say that if we look at something 10, 15, 20 years from now,
mm-hmm.
what would be, we're not necessarily, we're able to do it now, but years ago you weren't able to resurrect the speech, but you could look at the picture.
Right.
And the story that's on that.
Absolutely.
And so all over the world, folks are looking for little tidbits of history. That's your map.
Right.
Yeah, that's
your map.
Picture
speaks a thousand words.
And the picture
words.
Speaks a thousand
now,
words.
Now, tell me about Frank Sr. and Carmelita's, their children,
okay.
Your aunts and uncles,
yep.
And your dad.
Right, okay. They four children.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest was Hewitt Curry. She was a well-known musician, taught voice, piano, organ, directed choirs, and worked in gospel circles here for many, 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 many years. That's the oldest. Dad was the second oldest, Frank Merriweather Jr.
Frank Merriweather Jr.
We're stressing, right?
So many people confuse.
Right.
Frank Merriweather Jr. is the name attached to Frank Merriweather
Library,
which is
right.
Next door.
Right, right, right. So Frank Merriweather Jr. And right under was Thyra Charles. She was one of the first black nurses here
mm-hmm.
in the city. And the baby of the group is Judge Barbara Sims.
Judge Barbara Sims.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
she just transitioned a couple of years ago.
And she left a wonderful legacy in terms of
absolutely.
The legal profession.
Yes.
Did a number of things as first black judge, first black woman to work in the DA's office, and did a lot of heavy lifting. In that, in the legal industry, period.
Now, yeah. getting to your dad, was your dad the just the heir apparent to pick up the business?
Well, Dad had worked at, you know, it's funny. The girls, per se, kind of went off into their own professions. Per se, as I said, my oldest aunt went into music. Thyra went into nursing. Mm-hmm. And Barbara went into, actually, a lot of folks don't know, she was a school teacher. Barbara mm-hmm. Sims was a school teacher and scored number one on the teacher's exam. I guess that was, we'd be back in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and taught school for a number of years and then went into the legal profession. Yeah, yeah. But Dad always worked in the business there. And I'm thankful to the Lord that he chose my dad and my mother, Evelyn Patterson Ferguson,
mm-hmm.
as a means for me and my four siblings to venture into this place called Earth.
Right.
I'm really thankful for them because they did a lot. They worked really hard, and they were good parents to us. You know,
right.
I often think about just life lessons that they passed along. And my mother was really able to come in. She's kind of quiet, but still works and still participates in the business. And she's really the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her she's one of the top CEOs in all of Western New York, still working, still doing her thing, but really came in and was a wonderful, wonderful help me with my dad in terms of the second leg, per se, of the Criterion. Just was a fast learner. Picked up a whole lot of different things and was able really, you know, to carry things on after Dad passed, yeah.
Now, how big of an, it had to be a huge operation back in the day of photography and printing and putting out a paper.
Well, if you look back at a number of, because, you know, there were other newspapers here as well, but I think Dad revolutionized things in terms of the black press, in terms of putting in a photography and an engraving department.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing. And, you know, Pat, I only know, now there may be others, but I only know two families that produced their own product. And that was the Smitherman family who had the Buffalo Star
mm-hmm.
and the Buffalo Criterion. Now, the Smitherman family, they had a connection to the race riots in Oklahoma.
Okay.
Yeah, A.J. Smitherman.
Okay.
Was the editor and founder of the Star. And as I said, he had a few years ago, he was... the Uncrowned Queens did some work in his death to get a warrant removed
mm-hmm.
From him that went way back to the Oklahoma race riots.
Okay,
Tulsa, Oklahoma race riots. So, but they produced their own paper,
mm-hmm.
and we did too, but it was the difference is that we had put in an engraving department, which meant that you could now add pictures, and everything was produced in-house, per se. In other words, maybe 98% of the work that was done right inside our shop. We were actual, real newspaper publishers,
mm-hmm.
meaning that we produced that product.
Mm.
Yeah, we produced that product. And, you know, there was even an issue back in the day, you know, when Dad first decided to put this engraving department in, you know, he just wasn't able to go out and get a press camera. You know, there was some credentials, some other kind of things that he had to deal with, even in terms of law enforcement.
Right.
Yeah, you know, what are you going to do? What pictures are you going to take? Who are you going to send them to?
Was there any pushback from any other communities on the production of a black press back then?
Well, I don't think back then. I think that I don't think Frank Merriweather Sr. maybe didn't have to necessarily deal with that.
Okay.
I think that's because maybe the black community was small, and sometimes it's like in anything else. If a guy over across the street is doing well, Pat, and you're over here and you're a small organization, they're not necessarily so worried about you.
Right.
You know, they just continue to work and you continue to work. And you don't. And then the other thing too is there was an issue in terms of, again, telling our own story.
Right.
Yeah. You know, without some of sharp corners per se, they were able to round off the edges. They knew the people that they were dealing with, and you got a more focused presentation per se of the happening or the event. Yeah. And then small population, I get emails from all over.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is having something now. And it I don't think that the Frank and Carmelita Merriweather necessarily had to deal with it at that point.
How did they learn this business?
Tuskegee College. Yeah, they were.
Tuskegee was integral in teaching.
Oh, absolutely.
Trades,
you know, and Pat, more than one trade.
Yes.
You know, more than one trade. As I said, my grandfather, I know he was a tailor. He had a degree in tailoring.
Okay.
Yeah, from that machine shop. We were on 367 William, and that facility, they needed to enlarge that place, and that was something that they were able to do themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lay the brick, mix the mortar, you know, run the wires. It's not like it is now, but they believed in real craftsmanship and putting out a real A number one product, you know.
Now let's talk about Frank Jr.
Frank Jr.
Frank Jr. Picked up the mantle.
Picked up the mantle. And
did your Aunt Barbara play any role of the legal advice or?
Oh, absolutely. If I can, just I just want to step back to Frank Merriweather Sr.,
mm-hmm.
who went from the printing business into the newspaper business, which meant, you know, in my eyes, that he went really to the next level.
Yes.
Because everything at the newspaper level is bigger, meaning the machinery is bigger, the process is bigger, what you're doing is bigger, because really to put out a weekly paper, it's an awful lot of work.
A lot of work.
And at that time, that the process in which they were doing it, which was a letterpress process, was hard, heavy kind of work.
Mm.
You know, I'm not going to say most.
Mm-hmm.
All of our time in the newspaper business, we've put out a broadsheet paper, which not tabloid size, but we've always put out a broadsheet is a full sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Tabloid is usually half the size of a broadsheet paper. So we've always put out a broadsheet paper. And then just, Pat, if we take our phone, you know, or any means, everything is always changing. It's changing.
Yes.
Every day. It's changing every day, man. So I went to charge my phone, and the young lady told me that her charger wouldn't fit mine because I had a I don't even know what I had, Pat. I had something that her charger wouldn't fit my. I think she said she had an LX7 or LX.
Yeah, there's all different.
Yeah.
Things.
Yeah.
It's constantly something.
Yeah, she said, Mr. Frank, you know, you have an Android. So mm-hmm. I said, okay, all right. So, but the technology has changed. And even back then, you know, it was changing.
Now, let me ask you this. Did your grand? I knew he was active politically. Did he hold any appointments or offices?
Yeah, he was one of, I don't want to give you the right information, but he was one of the first blacks that worked in the New York State Assembly.
Yes.
As a clerk to Assemblyman, I think it was Barnhart.
Mm-hmm.
He worked there, and he did a number of jobs in terms of, probably the term, Pat, is appointments.
Okay.
That he had. I know he was in charge of the bathhouse on William Street, and maybe some other work. He worked in terms of dispensing news from the war into the black community as well, too. Yeah, so that might have not been an official position, but access to the news, so that the black community would be informed on that kind of work. Yeah.
Now, when did your dad begin moving into taking over?
Well, he had always said, you know, it was a funny thing. My grandmother, the editorial part, Frank Meriwether Sr. took care of most of that. Now, Dad did, too, later on. But the day-to-day operation, that was my father and my grandmother.
Okay.
On that, yeah.